Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
New Books in Southeast Asian Studies is sponsored by the ANU Southeast Asia Institute, the Griffith Asia Institute, the New York Southeast Asia Network, the Nordic Institute of Asian Studies, and the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Patrick Jory. I teach Southeast Asian history at the University of Queensland, and I'm co-host of this channel. The Vietnamese victory over French forces at Dien Bien Phu in 1954, which ended almost a century of French colonial rule in Indochina, is one of the most famous events in the history of anti-colonialism. How were the Vietnamese communists able to achieve this remarkable victory over a much more powerful colonial opponent? This is a question that Chris Gosha seeks to answer in his new book, The Road to Dien Bien Phu, A History of the First War for Vietnam, published by Princeton University Press this year. In doing so, Gosha re-enters the vexed debate about the relative importance of nationalism and communism in Vietnam's struggle against foreign powers. He puts forward a compelling argument about the importance of war communism to the Vietnamese victory over the French. Chris Gosha is Professor of History and International Relations at the University of Quebec in Montreal, Canada, and a prize-winning author of works on the modern history of Vietnam. Chris, thanks again so much for coming on New Books in Southeast Asian Studies for the second time.
Well, Patrick, thank you and your listeners for having me today. It's a real pleasure.
Now, although this book is about modern Vietnamese history, it actually deals with three of the biggest political ideas of the 20th century: anti-colonialism, nationalism, and communism. And you start off the book with a quote by that famous anti-colonial intellectual, Frantz Fanon, who's, I think, on the reading list of every post-colonialism course you do at university, who was involved with the independence movement in Algeria. And as you show, Fanon was very impressed with the Vietnamese victory over the French in Dien Bien Phu. And he asked at the time, how were the Vietnamese able to do that? And your book seems to be essentially an answer to, or an attempt to answer that question. Would that be right?
Yeah, you're spot on. You are. I stumbled across that quote while reading The Wretched of the Earth, which is indeed this famous treatise that he wrote in and published in 1961 on colonialism, a critique of French colonialism in particular. And it was in that book that he asked that question, and it struck me. So yes, to answer your question, I wanted to answer that question. What was it, as he said, that allowed the Vietnamese army to bring down the French army in a conventional battle at Dien Bien Phu in May of 1954?
The research for this book is so impressive. You use the contemporary scholarly research in English and French, the French colonial records, and an enormous number of Vietnamese sources. Can you tell us about the research and the sources that you used to write this book?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think that's to a large extent what allowed me to answer this question, or at least try to answer the question which Frantz Fanon posed in 1961. So on the one hand, I discovered, as some of your listeners may know, I spent a lot of time in France about 20 years before coming here to Montreal in 2005. And while I was in France in the 1990s and in the early 2000s, they started opening up the French military archives and the colonial archives on the Indochina War, the French Indochina War between 1945 and 1954, and the Algerian one as well, which we can get into a little bit later, between 1954 and 1962. So kind of this bigger Indo-Algerian War. So I was at the right place at the right time where I could get access to French archival documents. Now, if I could just say a little bit about that, that would be French reports, military reports, that would be colonial reports as well. But it was also a lot of intercepted documents. So they were Vietnamese documents to which I had access, often in Vietnamese or in French translation. When I say intercepted documents, I had access to a lot of what the French intelligence service were intercepting, radio intercepts. So it allowed me to have remarkable access to the Vietnamese side as well as to the French side. And so that was the French side there. Again, I was kind of in the right place at the right time in France in order to access a mass of information. On the Vietnamese side, it was also the opening up of Vietnam in the 1990s, and I think it's still going on at the archival level, but also the Vietnamese were publishing a massive amount of materials, much like the Chinese were doing after the end of the Cold War. Of course, they wanted to kind of present their side of the things, but in wanting to present their side of the things, they also, if I can put it this way, they presented a lot of things. So I had remarkable access to, for example, what the Vietnamese were doing with their radios, which is part of the book. We can talk about a little bit later what they were doing with their police services and, of course, what they were doing with their building their state and building their army as well. So your question is really important. I was kind of at the right place at the right time, both for being in France and for being able to go to Vietnam to snoop around. I did less work in the archives, to be honest with your listeners, because I had so much access to this published material. And perhaps I could say one last thing is that at the National Library in Hanoi, there's a big collection of what's called the Resistance Collection for the Indochina War, viewed from the Vietnamese side from 1945 to 54. And I had access to that Resistance Collection there.
On the surface, the book is a study of how the Vietnamese were able to defeat the French at Dien Bien Phu, but maybe more importantly, you seem to re-enter the debate about the relative importance of nationalism and communism in Vietnamese anti-colonialism. And you seem to argue that nationalism has perhaps been overemphasized and communism underplayed. Have I got that right?
No, I think you have it right. If you look at the way historians have written about the Vietnam War, both the French one and the American one, since I would say the 1950s in France, and certainly from the late 1960s and 1970s in the U.S. and in the other parts of the Anglophone world, the explanatory power of nationalism dominates. And communism is discussed, but it's not as important as I think it should be. So yes, to answer your question, I didn't want to throw nationalism out. I believe it still is important, but I did want to take a closer look at what was going on, if you will, on the communist side. And so nationalism, how would I put this? I think I put it at the conclusion. I cite Richard Overy, who's a specialist of the Second World War. It can influence how things go. It's certainly important, as we see in Ukraine, but it's not the only sole factor that can explain the victory of the Vietnamese army, again, at Dien Bien Phu in 1954. There's a number of other factors involved. And of course, one of those is the nature of communism itself.
Whenever we think of the Indochina Wars, we tend to think of North and South Vietnam, but your book introduces a really helpful, I think, new metaphor for understanding the Democratic Republic of Vietnam's political authority in Vietnam after 1945, and that is the archipelago state. Can you explain to the listener what you mean by this term?
Yeah, thank you, Patrick, for that question. It's a really important one. I think we have a tendency to see Vietnam either as in its kind of its S-like shape that we see on the map today, or we see it in its two-block form, which emerged with the Geneva Accords, which ended the French Indochina War in 1954 with a communist North Vietnam and a non-communist South Vietnam allied with the Americans. The problem is that there's a tendency to push one of those two things back into the past, and that's problematic because if you start at the beginning, as I try to do in 1945 and 46, it is true that for a very short period of time, Ho Chi Minh, in the wake of World War II, was able to create the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, which did, it wasn't easy, it was very fragile, but it did indeed control Vietnam from north to south. The problem is that the French came back. War broke out in the South in September of 1945 and in all of Vietnam in the North in December of 1946. And here I want to get to, I really want to answer your question, is that sovereignty, the control of the state, at this point, Ho Chi Minh state, shattered. I think that's important. And we see it in all kinds of wars. And certainly even it's shattered in Ukraine today as we speak. But in Vietnam, between 1945 and 1954, it shattered. So there was no S-like Vietnam. There was no North and South Vietnam. It was what I call this constellation of competing states. Of course, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh state was still there. The French colonial state was there. And as I try to introduce in the book as well early on, the French are going to foster the development of an associated state of Vietnam. So it's kind of yet another state at work in collaboration with the French. And these three states are competing for people. They're competing for materials. We see this in other wars as well. There's nothing necessarily unique about this, but it is something that I wanted to show to kind of complicate the way we've studied the wars for Vietnam from 1945, I would say, until the end of the Third Indochina War in 1991. So again, back to your question, it's a constellation. I play with this idea of an archipelago state. So the Vietnamese state run by Ho Chi Minh was an archipelago state with a capital that was in the hills of northern Vietnam, but it had islands scattered all around Vietnam, even into Laos and Cambodia. We can get into that a little bit later. But it had islands, which it had to connect. And we can talk about how you connect an archipelago. But one of the arguments is in my book is that you do. And you can see it in other type of wars as well.
Many people, including me, I have to say, tend to understand that the communist state of North Vietnam was established after the Geneva Accords in 1954. But what your book shows very convincingly is that the communists had actually started to construct all of the elements of a communist state in Vietnam pretty much immediately after Ho Chi Minh declares independence in September 1945.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think just to remind your listeners, if you don't mind, you do have the creation of a Vietnamese Communist Party in 1930, which was quickly rebaptized the Indochinese Communist Party in that same year, which would develop in the 1930s with a lot of difficulty. It would develop again during World War II when Ho Chi Minh would return to Vietnam in 1941. He would create a nationalist front, much like Mao Zedong had done in China before him, and that was the Viet Minh. Which was created in 1941. It was created by the communists. There's no denying that. It is important that we note that it was created by a communist party. Was it nationalist? Of course it was. And he would use that front to create a coalition, a wide coalition, which I can give examples for that all over the world history, if you like. But he would be able to take advantage of the end of World War II to take power in 1945. To get to your question again, because again, it's another important question. The communists would run the Viet Minh. They would run the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. But we have to keep in mind, if you don't mind, that at the beginning, they were a minority. There were only 5,000 communists in September of 1945 out of a population of 20 million Vietnamese. So they were in a weak position, but they did hold important positions, within the Democratic Republic of Vietnam from September 1945 until the end. Now, what I try to argue in my book, Patrick, is that war itself helped the communists to consolidate their hold over the state. And they're going to do this in two periods, the period between 1945 and 1950, which is kind of what I consider to be the guerrilla war period. And I'm really trying to get to your question here, 1950, when the Chinese communists come to power and they throw their support behind Ho Chi Minh, this opens up a new chapter, the second half of the Indochina War, when there's a new type of war which emerges, a conventional war with conventional battles against the French. And there's also a military revolution, but it's also goes in tandem with a political revolution from 1950, thanks to Chinese aid. And this is where, to answer your question, before 1954, 4 years before, the Vietnamese, with help from the Chinese they're able to consolidate their hold over the state. And that's very important. So they're going to use this new chapter in the war to expand their control over the state between 1950 and 1954. And they will be, by the end of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in May of 54, in a position of power. Do they control everything? No. But do they control much more than they did in 1945? Absolutely.
Can we just go back to 1945 for a minute, where, as you were saying before, your book shows, again, really clearly that the communists were weak. There was, I think you say, there's a limited number of trained cadre. There's no regular army. The administration is very weak. So they, as you say, had to rely to a considerable extent on various groups of non-communist anti-colonial Vietnamese. Can you tell us about these other groups and the relationship between the communists and the non-communists in the DIV in this early period, say 1945 to 50 or 51?
Yeah, that's, again, another good question. I would say there's two types of non-communists. I'm simplifying here, but I think largely this is accurate, what I'm going to say. On the one hand, you have a group of non-communists who were nationalists, they were anti-colonialist, and they were also anti-communist. This group is the Vietnamese Nationalist Party, which was formed in the late 1920s, and which came to life, as did the Vietnamese Communist Party, around this turning point of 1930. So this is an important group of non-communists who are there in the late 20s, 1930s, 1940s, and they're there in 1945 and 46 as well. Still with this group, they will oppose the French in 1945 and 1946, but they will also oppose the Vietnamese communists. They knew the Vietnamese communists well. They disagreed with their illogical promises for Vietnam. They were right. The Vietnamese nationalists, communists, wanted to create a communist government, and they did not. So what happened here is you have the outbreak of the first Vietnamese Civil War in 1945 and 1946, before the French actually can return to take colonial control of Indochina. So this first group is symbolized by the Vietnamese Nationalist Party. They know the Vietnamese Communist Party, and they disagree with them, and there will be the outbreak of a civil war in 45, and in particular in 46. There's other groups as well, religious groups in the South, of which Sean McKell has written, and others have as well. So there is a coalition of anti-communist Vietnamese nationalists. That's one group. There's another group who come out of the, obviously out of the 1930s as well, and they are ready to collaborate with the Vietnamese communists led by Ho Chi Minh in 1945 and 1946. They tend to be socialist, Republicans, Democrats. They are not as anti-communist as the Vietnamese Nationalist Party. They are willing to cooperate with the Vietnamese communists because they believe that the Vietnamese communists are sincere in their promises not to impose a single-party communist state. Again, we're in 1945, 1946, as you said, Patrick. And they make a bet, to be really honest. They bet and they make a bargain with the Vietnamese communists that we're all in this together. Our number one enemy is the French colonialists. We will fight them, and then we'll work things out later. And they believe that Ho Chi Minh when he said that there would be some sort of a kind of a democratic government coalition. The coalition would continue to exist as a democratic republican form of government. Don't forget that in 1945, 1946, Ho Chi Minh didn't even know that Mao Zedong was going to win in China. So no one knew the future at that time. I think it's important to keep that in mind. So I hope that's clear for you and your listeners. There was these two wings of Vietnamese non-communism, kind of a anti-communist, and they were Republicans as well, nationalism. And then this group, they who were willing to work with the Vietnamese Communist Coalition, thinking that it was indeed a coalition. Let me just end there by saying they would be disappointed from 1950 when they saw the Chinese communist victory and they saw the Chinese aiding Ho Chi Minh. And of course, in 1950, there were signs even before the Vietnamese communists made it clear that they were on their way to creating a single party communist state, whether the non-communists, their allies, liked it or not.
The other big argument in the book concerns the means by which the communists created this state. And you introduce the concept of war communism, which I understand you take from Lenin but use in a somewhat different way. Can you explain to the listener what you mean by war communism and how it fits into your argument?
Yeah, I think it's important not just to say, oh, the communists created a single-party communist state because Mao Zedong came to power in 1949 in China and supported the Vietnamese with military support and diplomatic support. I think it's important to think about, well, what did the Chinese provide to the Vietnamese communists? What did the Vietnamese communists know about communist methods of state building? So I was very interested in trying to understand what's the toolbox, what's the repertoire, what are the tools that they used in order to transform this coalition state into this single party communist state. And so this took me a while to kind of think about. And I said, well, where did Ho Chi Minh go? What did he know not only in 1950, but before? And I kind of started looking at what the Soviets were doing or what the Russians were doing during the Russian Revolution. This took me back to the Russian Civil War. And if you look closely at what's going on here, you can see that that the Bolsheviks are using war in order to develop certain, in order to create the single party communist state, but they're developing tools at this time. And then I also wanted to look at the tools that Mao Zedong developed in the 1930s. And there's a certain amount of tools that he had access to that were coming from the Soviets, coming from the Leninist model. And then I looked at what Ho Chi Minh was doing, and I noticed that he was also in the Soviet Union in the 1920s. Again, in the 1930s, he was in China when Mao was developing a communist model of warfare at Yan'an in the late 1930s. So I know this is a little bit complicated, Patrick, but there's a kind of a Eurasian arc of models that were being exported, that were being exchanged, that were moving from kind of the Soviet Union all the way to northern Indochina. And I wanted to identify those models. So here are some of the tools that I talk about that come from the Soviet Union. Rectification is one of these models. It's a communist model. You don't find it in Algeria. This is part of my answer to Fanon. This is a communist method of creating ideological-minded bureaucracy, a bureaucracy in the state, in the army, in the police services. And this is called rectification. The idea is that you're going to transform the way your civil servants, the way your military officers think about communism, but also think about their relationship to the party. So that's one example. Patriotic emulation. This is something that Lenin developed in, I believe, in 1922. The idea of identifying heroes within the different classes of the society, and then projecting these heroes that come from the peasant class, that come from the working class, that come from women, all different walks of life, that you will then extol and organize people around so that they support the party and the party's endeavor, in particular in war. So that's a second example. The third is one that existed in the Soviet Union, but it's one that Mao will turn into a specialty. It's land reform. The idea that you go into the villages, you break the control of the feudal landlords, and you replace them with the party. So that is a way by which the party is able to extend its control further down to the village level. But it's also a way of giving land to the peasants in order to mobilize them. I don't ask my listeners or my readers to agree with this, but I do ask them to take these models, these tools, seriously. Another one is the cult of personality. Ho Chi Minh follows Stalin's lead on that. Mao Zedong created a cult of the personality at Yan'an. He will then, use it as he consolidates power, obviously in the late 1940s, and then once he's in power in the 1950s. Ho Chi Minh is doing something similar here. So those are four examples, Patrick, of the tools in the war communist box, if you like. And Ho Chi Minh, I guess I would just end by saying, again, don't forget that he was a part of these international movements. A lot of people like to study Ho Chi Minh when he was in Paris, which is totally, totally understandable. There's a lot going on there. But I think we've neglected what Ho Chi Minh was doing with others in Moscow, in Yan'an, and then how he would bring these tools back and implement them with other communists in his party. So I hope that's clear for you and your readers, but there's a toolbox out there. Whether you agree with it or not, I'm trying to show readers that there's a Eurasian arc in which Ho Chi Minh is dipping into in order to build this single party communist state from 1950 in and of war, somewhat like Lenin did during the war communism period between 1919 and 1922 in Russia, and then what the Maoists were doing in China as well.
Yes, your book gives a lot of emphasis to Asian and, in fact, global support networks of the revolution. Ho Chi Minh, as you said, he's this incredible networker. He seems to know everyone everywhere.
That's true.
And particularly, he has these very important networks in Asia. Let's perhaps start with China. You've already mentioned China, but I wasn't quite aware of the extent of influence the Chinese communists had on Vietnamese communism going all the way back to the 1920s.
Yes, he is. He really is one of the global, a real revolutionary globetrotter. He definitely, as some of your listeners will know, he left in the 1910s. He went to France. He will, traverse the Atlantic. He will go to port cities in France, in Great Britain. He will end up in the United States briefly, and then he will go to Moscow, and then to southern China, which is a very important southern China in the 1920s, late 1920s, early 1930s. I mean, this is where he creates the Vietnamese Communist Party. It is not created in Vietnam. It is created like the Chinese Communist Party in a Chinese port. It happens to be a British colonial port, Hong Kong. And then if you don't mind me saying, Patrick, he will go further into Southeast Asia to preside over the creation of the Thai Communist Party, the Malaya Communist Party. He clearly played some sort of a role in the creation of the Laotian early embryonic Communist Party. So he's moving in these networks, these global networks. Whether one agrees with them or not, it doesn't matter. He was part of them, and he did indeed believe in them. And this is why I get back to, you mentioned it at the very beginning, was Ho Chi Minh a nationalist? Of course he was. I'm willing to admit that Mao Zedong was a nationalist as well. No problem there. But he was indeed a communist. And Mao Zedong, as we know, was indeed a communist. The only point I'm trying to make here is that it matters. It matters in terms of the state he wanted to create. It matters in terms of the networks within which he was moving. So Ho Chi Minh is also one of the founding fathers with Chinese and with Malays, with Thais, with Laotians of Southeast Asian communism as well, at least on the continental side of things. I don't think we need to get into what's going on in Indonesia, but again, these are wider global networks in which Ho Chi Minh was moving.
Of course, the victory of the Chinese Communist Party in China's Civil War in 1949 has a huge impact on the course of the war in Indochina. I wasn't quite aware how much. Can you perhaps tell us a little bit more there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think internally it allowed the Vietnamese communists to do two things. There's a military revolution. What does that mean? Well, that means that thanks to Chinese communist assistance, military assistance, thanks to Chinese military training, and this assistance that I'm talking about is it's heavy weapons. It's modern firepower. It's a little bit like the Americans helping the Ukrainians, if you don't mind me saying so. But now the Chinese were helping the Vietnamese. So that was a big change in the war. So that allowed the Vietnamese to operate what I consider to be a military revolution, which will not be duplicated by any other non-communist national liberation movement in the history of the 20th century. Why? Because this allowed the Vietnamese communists to create a professional army. What does that mean? Well, again, it's something similar to what the Ukrainians have. They do indeed have a guerrilla army in Ukraine. We know that, but they also have a professional army with divisions. So the Vietnamese created a divisional army with seven divisions, with even an artillery division by Dien Bien Phu. It matters, Patrick. It does matter. So this military revolution is very important. It also allowed the Vietnamese Communist Party to take the army in to hand, which they will do with these tools of which I spoke a moment ago, rectification, emulation, and we can come back to that if you like. That's one revolution. The second revolution is the political revolution, of which I just spoke. I won't go into details here, but from 1950, thanks to the Chinese communist victory, they had access to models. They had access to about 200 Chinese advisors came in. So just as you have advisors, British, American advisors helping out the Ukrainians, and it's not a negative thing, it's not a positive thing, it's just a reality in war, the Chinese are providing advisors, political advisors and military advisors. That's very important, and that helps the Vietnamese communists transition to a new type of war and a new type of state, as we've already discussed. Internationally, third thing I think is important is that the Americans were following all this. Again, whether one agrees with the Americans or not doesn't really matter in terms of what I'm trying to demonstrate in my book, is that the Americans were looking at what was going on in Indochina in terms of a global vision, in terms of a global containment policy, excuse me, that they had been developing. It had been limited to Europe, to Western Eurasia, until 1950, but with the victory of the Chinese communists and, of course, with the outbreak of the Korean War in June of 1950, this really did globalize American containment policy, and they saw this as the Chinese communist victory, the war in Korea, as a threat to their hold over the Pacific. So this is an argument which I make in the book, is this helps explain why the Americans intervened indirectly in Indochina. They support the French. They're going to provide arms to the French, napalm, planes. And this makes the Indochina War the most violent war of decolonization in the 20th century. Nothing of the sort occurs in Algeria or in Indonesia. Again, this has nothing to do about the levels of nationalism among Indonesian Republicans or Algerian nationalists. It's the nature of the war that happens to develop on the southern flank of China and on the western rim of what I think is an American maritime empire. So the Americans intervene indirectly behind the French in Indochina. And don't forget, they intervened directly in Korea. So that's the third thing to answer your question about the importance of the Chinese communist victory. I would say also the Korean War. This really does commit the Americans. So for me, the American war in Indochina, I'm not the only person to say this, but it certainly begins in 1950, not in 1954, certainly not in 1965.
Your point about the Chinese assistance to the Vietnamese communists and the establishment of a regular army, this is another thing that one of the many things I learned from your book. I think when most people think of the First and Second Indochina Wars, they tend to think of guerrilla warfare. And, of course, there is some of that, but you show that the Vietnamese communists actually won the First Indochina War through conventional warfare, using a regular army, the People's Army of Vietnam, which they had been building up. Can you perhaps say a little bit about the importance of the establishment of this regular army?
Yeah, I don't think it could be underestimated. If I can come back just to 1945, when the war breaks out, the First Indochina War breaks out, I think it's important to remember that, yes, as Ho Chi Minh said to an American journalist in Paris in 1946, he told him, "We will fight a guerrilla war. No, we do not have heavy arms. No, we do not have a professional army, but we do have nationalism." And this is the famous parable that he tells of the tiger fighting the elephant, the tiger, of course, being the Vietnamese tiger, which will attack the big French modern army elephant at night. It will attack it, jump on its back, rip off parts of its back. It'll be a long war, a slow war, but eventually the Vietnamese will win because of nationalism. Again, I get back to your first question. Nationalism is important. I think we see it in Ukraine right now, but it's one factor, and it's an important factor, but it's not the only factor. So you have this kind of idea of the tiger, guerrilla warfare, fighting the elephant, modern warfare. That is certainly the case between 1945 and 50, but everything changes from 1950 because of what we've just discussed, the aid which the Chinese provided, the training which they provided. But I would say one thing which is really important here is that during that kind of tiger versus the elephant period, the Vietnamese communist leadership understood the importance of developing, even before 1950, a modern professional army. Did it have divisions before 1950? No. Was it guerrilla-based? Yes. Did it avoid engaging the French head-on in conventional battle? Yes. But what is very important here, and I think we see this in Ukraine as well since 2014, is that they knew, even from as early as 1946, that they had to create the start of a professional army. Which meant what? Which meant that they had to have a radio system, a radio division within the army. They had to have an intelligence systems within the army. They had to have a logistics system within the army. They had to eventually have training programs within the army, that it couldn't just be. And again, this is not negative, and I'm not implying that all guerrillas are ragtag armies. I'm not saying that. But the Vietnamese had, they understood early on that they had to be in a position to be able to be there, to actually be there in 1950 when the Chinese arrived at the border, in order to be able to use this modern equipment that the Chinese were going to be able to give them. I think we see something similar going on in North Korea. We see it here in Vietnam, because had the Vietnamese not had the embryo, if I can put it that way, of an army in 1950, I do believe that modern weapons would have just rusted at the border. Because if you don't have an army that has the training already to use it, because that the Battle of Cao Bang, the first conventional battle which the Vietnamese win, that was in October of 1950. So whatever the weaknesses of the Vietnamese army were from 45 to 50, whatever the weaknesses of the Tiger were, and they were many, the Tiger was in a position, if I can put it that way, from 1950 to start to turn itself into an elephant. And again, that process would be full of bitter defeats between 50 and 54. But when we get to the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, and it was an incredible battle. It was a violent battle. It was the most violent battle of decolonization of the 20th century, in my opinion. But that tiger that was there, it wanted to be an elephant. And when I say, Patrick, it wanted to be an elephant, it fought trench warfare. Guerrillas never fight trench warfare, ever. And that's why French officers, some of whom had seen World War I, referred to Dien Bien Phu as a Verdun. And to some extent, if you look at the photos of the battlefield, well, that's what the Vietnamese Tiger did. It fought like an elephant. It won that battle. And we can't take that away. And I wouldn't want to take it away from the Vietnamese. So, yeah, I think you ask another excellent question. The military revolution is extremely important, and that it's that process that goes from 1945 to 1954, the desire of this tiger to turn itself into an elephant. I won't go into this, but I would say that that came with huge social costs for the Vietnamese people as well. That type of warfare, conventional battles, eight in all between 1950 and 54.
The book lays out all the different dimensions of the struggle against the French, and I don't think I'm going to have time to go into all of them, but I do want to mention one of them. You show that the French launched a very effective economic war on the DRV with the apparent objective of starving the Vietnamese forces. Can you tell us a little bit about this economic warfare and how the Vietnamese attempted to circumvent it?
Yeah, this is one of the unknown chapters of the French Indochina War. To my knowledge, this has never been written about. It's not that I want to vaunt myself for having written about it in my book. To be quite honest, I stumbled across it while I was going through all of these documents in the French military archives, about which I spoke at the beginning here, and I discovered that there was an economic aspect to this, which existed from the beginning. There was always an attempt by the part of the French to stop the Vietnamese, their adversaries, from supplying themselves, from feeding themselves, from trading with Thailand, for example, from trading with southern China. And so there was this economic dimension from the beginning to the end of the French Indochina War. I knew that to some extent from earlier work I had done on kind of commercial networks with Southeast Asia, as you may know. what I didn't realize was the extent to which the French would go from 1950 when the war was internationalized. I didn't realize the extent to which the French army, and they must have had the backing of the French political class, to what extent I don't yet know, but I'm working on that now. But they organized a systematic economic war against the Vietnamese from 1950, and then in particular from 1952. What does that mean? That means the mobilization, above all, of the Air Force. And this is something that the Americans were doing in Korea, and the French knew this. They were following closely what the Americans were doing during the Korean War. The French began what I do call in my book strategic warfare. Strategic warfare, as we know from World War II, means that you target the industries, you target to some extent civilians as well during World War II, to wipe out their capacity to feed themselves, to supply themselves, this sort of thing. So the French bombed industries, but of course the Vietnamese didn't really have industrial development, much less than the Koreans did, for reasons I won't get into. And then the French began bombing the capacity of the Vietnamese to feed themselves. That meant what? Ironically, that meant bombing dikes, dams that the French themselves had built during the colonial period in a bid to, yes, and this is quotes that come from the organizers on the French side of this, to starve the Vietnamese into defeat, to increase the suffering, I think we have to say this, the suffering of the Vietnamese civilian population so that they would stop supporting the communists. Again, we see this in other wars. There's nothing new about what the French are doing. It's just that we've never realized the extent to which they went to do this. So bombing was a big part of this. Bombing was part of it. The other part of it was actually rice wars. And this will be the last example I give. I think I give some pretty interesting examples. The war went into rice, to the rice fields. There was two harvests in Vietnam. Let's just say in April and again in October. It's not that case all over Vietnam, but in the key areas that Ho Chi Minh controlled, where he was getting his food, the French either bombed or they sent troops in to take the harvest before the Vietnamese could get it. So one of the things I try to show in the book is the totalizing aspect of this war, the extent to which the French and the Vietnamese communists as well, they expanded this war, to be quite honest, Patrick, into people's stomachs. Again, we see this in other wars, even again in Ukraine to some extent. Today, there's economic aspect that's going on. So this is something important in my book, and I thank you for asking that question, because it's something that I'm working on right now as well.
Before we get back to the war in Vietnam, I'd just like to move to a related topic. That is something which I understand is quite a sensitive topic today. That is the Vietnamese communists' own imperialist ambitions in Indochina, and in particular, Ho's contribution to building communist parties and states in Laos and Cambodia, which is a kind of a communist imperialism. In fact, just as the French are establishing their associated states of Indochina, the Vietnamese communists are trying to establish their own empire in Laos and Cambodia. Am I kind of exaggerating what you're trying to argue?
No, you're not. You're not. I think one of the things I try to show in the book as well, and I hesitated before including that chapter, but in the end I said, no, I have to include this chapter on Ho Chi Minh's Indochina, Ho Chi Minh's Associated States. That's the title of that chapter. So as you so well put it, just as the French created Associated States in 1949 and 50 for Vietnam, for Laos and for Cambodia. They worked with Sihanouk. In Laos, they worked with Sisavong. Of course, in Vietnam, it was with Bao Dai. They created what they called Associated States. But I think what readers don't realize is that the Vietnamese communists were following closely what the French were doing. So there's kind of a mirror effect going on here. And they created their own Associated States of Indochina. I think the evidence is just absolutely overwhelming. And again, it's I rely I, I, I on Vietnamese publications and all sorts of different sources, but that come from the Vietnamese communists themselves, and which show without a doubt that they are creating their associated states as a reaction to what the French were doing. So there's a geopolitical side to it. But what I try to show as well, and I'm relying on some of the new imperial history that's going on, we're moving beyond, I think some listeners probably know that it's not just the French Empire, it's not just the British Empire that historians are working on. We're now working on, let's be honest, the Russian Empire. We see it with what's going on now. The American Empire, we've done that for a long time, but we're starting to work on Asian empires and other empires as well, the Ottoman Empire, et cetera. So I, Patrick, kind of tapped into that historiography, and I got to be honest with you, it was extremely helpful. It was extremely helpful. So am I trying to write an accusatory history of Vietnamese communist imperialism? Not really, but I am trying to show that it's not just a reaction to what the French are doing, and it's also the Vietnamese are coming out of their own imperial history, which predates the French, which goes back centuries. And I think it makes for a very interesting, it shows us something interesting about the Vietnamese, just as that would show us something interesting about the Chinese, about the Americans, or about the French, you know, Third Republic and what they did in Indochina and Algeria. I know that doesn't please a lot of readers. It certainly doesn't please some of my readers in communist Vietnam, but I'm not here to please readers all the time, but I am trying to show that there's something bigger going on. So thank you again for asking about that chapter. I think it's an important chapter. I would just add one thing, if you don't mind, is that the Vietnamese are, that means that the Vietnamese from 1950 in particular, the Vietnamese communists are deeply involved in state building in Laos and Cambodia, just as the French were, but it's a counter state building. And so they're on the tip of this arc, you know, this Eurasian arc that I'm talking about. But I think it's interesting to note that the Vietnamese communists, they didn't apply the entire toolbox that they were applying in Vietnam. So they used different tools. They developed different tools that they would use in Laos and Cambodia. And with results that we can talk about a little bit later, but after 1954, which have the differing results in Cambodia on the one hand, and in Laos on the other.
Yeah, look, I found that chapter really fascinating. But if we need to return to the war, one of the themes of the book is the enormous suffering that the struggle against the French caused for the peasantry in particular. And you use a metaphor somewhere that the peasantry were caught between the hammer and the anvil of the French and the DRV forces, which I think was quite evocative. Eventually, this results in famines in central and northern Vietnam in 1952-53, both because of the French economic warfare that you just talked about, as well as the DRV's own demands on the peasantry to support the war effort. Can you perhaps sort of just describe the sort of situation at that time?
Dire would be my first answer for this period between 1950 and 54. It was difficult before, but now it becomes absolutely dire for the peasant population. Is it all of the peasant population in Vietnam? No. It's in these areas now which are more and more mobilized for these conventional battles. So the peasantry, for example, living in a zone, I tried to show that there's important zones south of Hanoi. We have this idea of like everything's going on the border. Yes and no. There's a zone south of Hanoi, which is very important. It's in central Vietnam. It's controlled by the Vietnamese communists. It's what we call zones 4 and 5. Yes, in the north, you have the upland zones, which border on China. It's the northern zone, and that too is a very important zone, which is touched by this mobilization for conventional warfare. So when I say mobilization, I think there's two things that we have to think about. On the one hand, the Vietnamese Communist Party is mobilizing the population like never before, and this never happens in the South. They're mobilizing the population because they've incorporated the draft. The Algerians never incorporated the draft. The conscription. A conscription army was declared in 1949. A general mobilization was declared in 1950. What does this mean? That means that the state is going down through these tools I talked about in order to draft young men, also to collect rice. I won't get into the details, but the state now needs rice from the villages, from the peasants, like never before. In a guerrilla, when you had the tiger was kind of eating off, if you allow me to say this, off the villages. Often the tiger soldiers were villagers themselves. Something else is going on now with these seven divisions I talked about a moment ago. They have to eat, and they eat a lot of rice. So that means that the state, the communist state, is going down and taking rice. They can say that this is for nationalism all they want, but for the peasants, this is a serious situation because they have to give that rice, but they didn't have a lot of rice anyways to give. And this is where things get very, very precarious for the Vietnamese peasant populations. Again, Patrick, south of Hanoi, in this vast area in central Vietnam and in the upland area bordering on China, where there's not a lot of rice being grown in that upland area anyways, because the French control the Red River Delta and the Mekong Delta. So this mobilization is making it very difficult for Vietnamese peasants. Second thing, it's the French economic warfare. I won't repeat what I said a moment ago, but the man you cited, this between the hammer and the anvil, he was one of the organizers of the economic warfare, the systematic economic warfare between 1950 and 1954, which really came into its own in 1952. The French were trying to stop the Vietnamese communists from getting access to that rice, from feeding their army. And that meant that the French, as I mentioned a moment ago, they're going into the villages. And this is what's absolutely fascinating. But for the Vietnamese peasants, it's tragic. It's brutal. It's violent. I don't know how to, I try to explain it to readers, but they are caught between the anvil and the hammer, as you said. And that's why I cited one of the architects of the French economic warfare. He knew what was going on because he was one of those organizing it. So you have this double attack by the French and by the Vietnamese communists on the Vietnamese peasant population. And it does trigger. Christian Lenz has showed this as well for the uplands in northwestern Vietnam. I think there's much more to be done on this. I hope others will get involved. But this is important to understanding the end of the Indochina War because, yes, Patrick, the Vietnamese communists won the war with this conventional battle, but they negotiated and they accepted only half of Vietnam at the Geneva Accords that were signed in 1954. One of the reasons I argue, and I'm saying this modestly, but I think it's an important reason, is that socially, economically, Ho Chi Minh knew that he had exhausted the peasant population, that he was driving them into the ground with the French. He was driving them into the ground, and that if he pushed any further, my argument is that he risked bringing down the whole communist temple, this single party state, on top of his head.
Yeah, look. When I was reading the book, I was waiting for you to discuss the famous land reform program that they launched in 1953, and I thought, oh, maybe it's already been done. He's going to leave it out, but then at the end, you put it in there perfectly, sort of related to your argument. You know, when they dispossessed the so-called feudalists of the land, they killed and persecuted thousands of people, and rather than attribute this to the implementation of Orthodox communism, you explain the reason for the land reform program in quite a novel way. And it blew me away at that part point in the book. Can you tell the listeners what lay behind their decision to embark on this full-scale class war right on the eve of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu?
Yeah, well, yeah, you're really good. Yeah, I was going to flow into this, but I see that you're on it already, which is quite impressive. Yes, that was exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to deal with the land reform differently because I'm convinced, I could be wrong, maybe someone will tell I am, but it seems to me that land reform, the timing of land reform, is linked to what we have just discussed, Patrick. And it really only gets started in this 1952-53 period. And I think that Ho Chi Minh, others in his party, they realized that they were in trouble and that if they were going to take it to the French, if they were going to really organize this big battle of Dien Bien Phu in particular, they had to implement war communism, at least the Maoist form of war communism, which meant land reform. They had to give something to the peasants they were driving into the ground with the French again since about 1950 in central and in northern Vietnam. So they had to go into the villages with this bureaucratic rectified class, with the army. They had to do this now, which means early 1953, and then they had to accelerate it in 1953 and 54. Which meant that they needed to break the feudalist landlords who were controlling things. To what extent that's true, I have some doubts. But one thing is, they had to put their hands on rice like never before, but they also had to mobilize and promise to the peasant populations in central and northern Vietnam, we need your help one last time. It's similar to what the Chinese communists were doing in the late 1940s. We need you to join up for the army. We need you to join these work crews to fix the bridges. We need you to carry medicines. The mobilization was absolutely extraordinary that was going on between 1554, and they had to mobilize 250,000 people, civilians, one last time for Dien Bien Phu. So, yes, my argument here is that you cannot understand land reform without hooking it up to the military political situation, which developed from 1952 in particular on till the end of the Indochina War. So this is why I combined. It's a long chapter. I know it's a little bit maybe too long, but I put land reform in my discussion of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. And you put your finger spot on, Patrick, on what I was trying to do in the denouement of my book.
When you read about the land reform program and the thousands who executed and persecuted in ways, sometimes it's just numbers. But there's one particular example that you gave, I thought it was very poignant, of this very prominent patriotic anti-colonial businesswoman, Nguyen Thi Nam, I think. And can you perhaps say a little bit about her and why you sort of gave her example?
Yeah, because she's symbolic in a way. She's symbolic of the communist decision to put an end to this coalition we talked about that dates from 1945 and 46 with non-communist anti-colonialists who were willing to work with them. What I mean by that, this is a remarkable woman. She's been talked about thanks to Vietnamese, French, and American researchers. We know a lot about her. But she supported the Vietnamese communists. She supported the anti-colonialist movement. She was considered to be the mother of the resistance by the Vietnamese communists themselves. The leadership knew her. Ho Chi Minh knew her. But they decided to sacrifice her as an example, as kind of a war communist trials example in 1953. So I made a point of including that because we can't avoid, we can't gloss over what Ho Chi Minh himself authorized. The idea that Ho Chi Minh wasn't involved with this is just disingenuous, and I refuse that. They organized her execution. She was no longer the resistance mother. She was no longer a member of a coalition, anti-colonialist coalition. She was a terrible feudalist. And so they had her executed for the example so that it was clear what the communists were going to do now, that the feudalist class had now been excluded from the coalition state. And so this, too, is yet another example. The Vietnamese communist Ho Chi Minh at the head of that, he said, we will create this communist state and you will not stop us. And as an example of this communization process, of this war communism, which I try to develop, they decided to kill this woman, an all-male party too, or almost all-male, but at least those who made that decision, they executed the resistance mother of their own coalition government in order to push through this communization of their state and to push through land reform and to exclude, the feudalist class, which to them she now represented and only represented.
If we could zoom out for a moment and tell me if I'm misinterpreting you, but it seems to me that your book is at least partially a response to the, let's say, romantic view that's quite common in the West right now, particularly amongst students, I find. That is that the First Indochina War, the result was victory of the nationalists fighting to win their country back from the colonialists. So it's an easy sort of moral equation there. But it seems to me that you argue that it's really war communism, that is a communist state forged through warfare, that's what is responsible for delivering victory at Dienbien Phu, for better or for worse. Do I have that
right? I think that's largely true. I don't know if I'm really trying to argue against, there is a historiography out there. There's a school out there that does tend to romanticize Ho Chi Minh and the struggle against the French and then the struggle against the Americans. I mean, I think, as I said earlier, the Vietnamese communists led the war, an anti-colonialist war, and they did win at Dien Bien Phu. We can't take that away from them, and I don't want to take it away from them. They were impressive. They fought the French in ways few others did, in this long Indo-Algerian war I was talking about a moment. Again, I'm not minimizing what the Algerians did, but we have to recognize that there was no Dien Bien Phu in Algeria. That's just a reality. At the same time, I think in the 2010s, when I was preparing this book, and today in 2022, I think we have much more sophisticated war studies that are out there. We have these economic studies I was talking about. I think we're away from the end of the Cold War. We're away from the anti-war movement, against the Americans and that sort of thing. I think we know now too that the Chinese communists, the Soviets, and the Vietnamese as well, they have done some very problematic things. And so I guess to answer your question is, to quote Mao, if I can quote Mao, let 100 flowers bloom. And so I think that was kind of my, something that I wanted to do is just let the evidence speak for itself and then take things in theoretical ways that I wanted to do it. So is nationalism important? Yes. Does it explain everything, as many historians have said in the 1960s and 70s? No, it does not. There's other things that are going on. And if you want to really understand how the Vietnamese, to answer Franz Fanon's question that we started with at the beginning, how the Vietnamese brought down the French army, the elephant, at Dien Bien Phu in 1954, it's not enough just to talk about nationalism. We have to talk about these other factors. And one of the main factors that explains it for me is war communism, which was manifest at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in May of 1954.
Even though it's just come out this year, the book's already received rave reviews among scholars in Western countries. My guess is that the book may not be looked upon quite that favorably in official circles in Vietnam. Can I ask if you've had any feedback on the book from Vietnamese scholars in Vietnam, or indeed in other countries around the world?
Not yet in Vietnam. It is true with my previous book, Vietnam, A New History, I got into trouble, for example, on a number of things. I'm still waiting to hear. The book came out officially in March of 2022, so perhaps we need a little bit more time. I know, to answer your question, I have not heard back yet. I do think some of the chapters will get me in trouble, perhaps a little bit in Vietnam, with certain maybe official historians who don't like the idea that there's more to it than a heroic nationalist struggle that explains the Vietnamese communist victory in 1954. So, yes, I think that could be a problem. Certainly my chapter on Indochinese, on Vietnamese empire building of a revolutionary kind, I'm assuming that will probably get me into a little bit of trouble in Vietnam, and perhaps also in Laos and Cambodia as well. But I have not heard yet. It is true in France. It's interesting. In France, it's a mixed bag. I do publish in French, as some of your listeners may know, and some on the French side, they're more than happy to have me talk about war communism, about Ho Chi Minh using this toolbox, creating a single party state, etc. But some people are not happy about me talking about the French economic war, strategic bombing, the bombing of the Vietnamese, and the brutal impact of French warfare on Vietnamese civilians. That's gotten me, I wouldn't say it's gotten me into trouble, but certainly the French are much more interested in what's going on in Algeria. So it's quite a surprise. The last month or so, I've published a number of things which have shown that, the French Indochina war between 1945 and 1954, and I say this in the French publications, was the most violent war of decolonization of the 20th century. And that for the French blows some minds. And so there's some people who aren't happy with this, but I cite Bernard Fall, who's certainly not a communist Frenchman. I think many of your listeners will know Bernard Fall, but he's the one who said in 1965 that the Indochina War between 1945 and 1954 killed 1 million Vietnamese who were mainly civilians. So that's gotten me into a little bit of some debates in France, to answer your question.
This may be an impertinent question, given that you've just finished a big book published this year, but can I ask if you're working on a new project, Pam? Can you give us a little insight into what that project might be?
Yeah, a little bit. I have to write it. I'm a little bit behind the gun here, but I'm slated to write kind of a global history of the wars for Vietnam from the 18th century to the present. So I want to write kind of a geopolitical, kind of a global history. So I won't be going to the ground level as I like to do, but as I think you and maybe some of your listeners might know, I do like to go to the global level every now and then. So this one's going to be kind of a global take to explain why Vietnam, maybe a little bit like Ukraine. It was before the war in Ukraine started, but I stumbled across a book on Ukraine and the idea that there's certain places in the world for all sorts of different reasons, but they become these places where empires like to go, they like to grow, and they also collide. So that's the object of my next book, is to explain why Vietnam was so important to so many people over such a long period of time.
Chris Gosha, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of New Books in Southeast Asian Studies to discuss your new book, The Road to Dien Bien Phu, A History of the First Indochina War, published by Princeton University Press in 2022.
Thank you, Patrick, and thank you to your listeners. It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
And you've been listening to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thanks, as always, for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, then you might also be interested in listening to other podcasts about books that deal with Vietnam's modern history, like Chris's award-winning earlier book, Vietnam, A New History, published by Basic Books in 2016, or Sean McHale's The First Vietnam War, Sovereignty and the Fracture of the South, 1945 to 56, published by Cambridge in 2021. You can download or stream these interviews and thousands more free of charge via the New Books Network website or iTunes.